Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Men whose intelligence we both admire and are privileged to be able to tap with regularity is that of Bill Walton. He is, of course, best known these days, perhaps for his outstanding television podcast program, The Bill Walton Show. He has a couple of other attributes that we find very, very valuable in our conversations with him, particularly about matters economic and financial, and that is his experience on Wall Street as the president and CEO of Allied Capital Corporation, and subsequently his leadership of the Council for National Policy, which I'm proud to be a member. Bill, it's great to have you back.
Frank, welcome. Thank you.
Boy, a lot to talk about in the economic warfare space, that's for sure. Bill, give us sort of a 30,000-foot level assessment of how we're watching economic warfare be waged, it seems with considerable effect at the moment, by European nations, both in NATO and some not, as well as, to some extent, the United States under the administration of Joe Biden.
Well, the West has launched aggressive, unprecedented economic sanctions against Russia and Putin. And the thing that stands out,
over the matter of its invasion of Ukraine.
Well, yes. I think that was a game changer. And I think it was a wake-up call for the EU, and no more so than in Germany. Under 16 years of Angela Merkel, they've been totally in Russia's pocket and getting and growing more and more dependent upon Russian gas and shutting down its nuclear program and trying to go green with wind and solar and putting the German economy and the German people in an incredibly precarious position. Well, this weekend, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced a complete reversal of virtually everything that she'd been putting in place, including the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which was all set to go and was being studied and expected to go out and online in this summer. They've shut the quote study down, and the expectation is they're not going to open it up. The other thing that's fascinating is that the chancellor was a member of the Green Party, and of course they've been against all of these fossil fuels, and now in addition to trying to drive Germany's production of fossil fuels up, he's now urging reactivating a lot of the old nuclear power plants and is advocating building more. And that's also a complete reversal from where the Green Party's been. And, what they're seeing is that Putin wants to reestablish the Russian Empire, and the Germans have woken up from this dream they've been in the last 20, 25 years and are now prepared to step up, and including Germany's contribution to NATO. He pledged 100 billion euro or 105 billion euro, $110 billion to its defense effort to get it up to 2%. And of course, this is what Donald Trump was lecturing about for year after year after year, and everybody thought Trump was way out of line. Well, it turns out Trump was exactly right, and the Germans now agree they need to be able to prepare to defend themselves.
There is, of course, a certain fluidity to all of this, and I personally would be a little dubious that we won't see that Nord Stream pipeline, the second one, brought online in due course, having invested as much as they have and frankly having become as dependent upon Russian energy as the Germans have. And the same might be said of their commitment to finally step up on some of their obligations to enhance their military preparedness. But it's a positive development, that's for sure. And I guess it calls to mind that old line about conservatives being liberals mugged by reality. maybe Greens and socialists in Germany are being now bugged by reality and braced up in a way that let's hope is enduring, because it's absolutely vital to having the kind of deterrent effect that one has hoped for long before now. Bill, as we're speaking, of course, the war is still going on in Ukraine. There's a large convoy of military vehicles headed towards Kyiv, as it's called these days, that suggests that it's going to become much uglier and particularly more deadly for the people of the capital of Ukraine, and perhaps the people of Ukraine more broadly, which makes all the more interesting what kind of toll is all of this taking on this economic warfare, that is, on the Russian economy, the currency of Russia, the capital markets of Russia.
Well, the other thing of note was that the European ministers got together this weekend and virtually unanimously voted to impose the toughest economic sanctions they ever. And the pivot point in this, I guess, was the call that the Prime Minister of Ukraine came on, dialed into the meeting, pleading for help. And he said, this is probably the last time you'll see me alive. And he gave a very emotional 10-minute speech. And after that speech, it really turned the room around. And the Germans, who had been skeptics, really turned on a dime during that meeting. And the sanctions, you know, the big one is the limiting Russian banks' access to the SWIFT system, which is that short term for Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications. It's essential. It's the Gmail for banks. I mean, if you want to send money around, this is what you use. And they've cut off all the banks in Russia, interestingly, except the ones that handle the gas sales, and because they don't want to cut off the energy supplies to the EU. But except for that, it is having a very crippling effect in the Russian economy. Oil and gas is only about 20%. Only, that's a lot, about 20% of the Russian economy. And they've had a fairly vibrant tech sector. And that piece of the world and that piece of the Russian economy has been incredibly crippled by these sanctions. And they really can't do business because they can't get access to their capital. There's a case of one small tech company that had $2 billion or $2 million set aside for just this kind of eventuality. And now, because of the SWIFT system being shut down, they can't reach it. We're seeing a run on ATMs in Russia. We're seeing the economic shock here is tremendous there. They could see their GDP fall by 10-15%. And Frank, your word dubious, that's a good word when it comes to the tough intentions of the EU, but what's not in question is that the Russian economy is really quite small. It's 11th in the world, smaller than South Korea, highly dependent on oil and gas. These sanctions are cutting off the vibrant part of the Russian economy. Russian GDP has been flatlined for the last 10 years. And most importantly, the GDP per person has dropped from about $16,000 to $10,000 since 2012. And when you look at that amazing photo,
which is all the more remarkable given that the size of the population has dropped, so you'd think that it would be staying more or less static, even if GDP is declining.
Which makes matters even worse. But for me, the image that stands out is that astonishing photo of Vladimir Putin meeting this weekend with his top advisors on the economy. And he's sitting at the head of a...
Meeting remotely.
He's sitting at the head of a 50-foot-long table, and his advisors are all the way down at the other end of the table. There are about five or six of them clustered around. Evidently, Putin has been absolutely in a state of paranoia about the virus and has been social distancing, and this is the most extreme example, and we've got photos to prove it. But the other thing is he doesn't use a cell phone. He doesn't use the internet. He thinks that it has all been engineered by the CIA, so he won't touch the electronic world, and he's very out of touch. And it just makes you wonder whether Putin really has all the power that we think he has, because if the economy is going to go south, further south from the direction it's going, the billionaires are already complaining that we shouldn't, the Russian plutocrat billionaires, oligarchs, that's their word, they're all complaining about this. You have to wonder how long Putin is going to be able to hold the whip hand. And I see that as an extremely, you could say, well, if they get rid of him, that could be a very positive thing, and Europe would or Russia would stand down and bring Europe back to some sense of stability. But my biggest fear is that Putin is a man who's in his desperate last hours, and that old play movie in the 50s called The Mouse That Roared, about a little country that declared war in the United States to be recognized and get foreign aid. Well, I think economically, Russia is the mouse that roared, but it's a mouse that has 5,000 nuclear weapons aimed at Europe and the United States. The unknown here is China. You know, they had a nice meeting during the Winter Olympics, Putin and Xi. Xi promised support for Putin, but Xi also wants to do business with Europe. And he has to worry about all the business and all the economic relationships that China wants to have with Europe. And with the EU, at least for the time being, turning very tough on Russia, where's Xi going to come out here in terms of supporting Putin? I don't think we know, but it's something to watch.
It is indeed. It's made more interesting by something our colleague Bill Gertz pointed out in the Washington Times a day or two ago, namely that China actually signed a treaty with Ukraine to guarantee their security in the event there was a nuclear threat emanating against it and tied into an invasion specifically. And this would seem to make even more problematic Xi's alliance with Putin.
Well, I want to use a stronger word than dubious, because Russia is like, or China is likely to agree to a treaty based on international law, as much as they're bound to agree not to steal tech secrets.
Oh yeah, no. Look, I'm under the illusion about
we have
this.
A piece of paper signed by China. Yeah, that's worth a lot.
Right. Push comes to shove, he's going to align, I'm sure, with Vladimir Putin. But the point is that, as you were suggesting, it's gotten more complicated for China, I think, than they had probably bargained on. And it may, especially if this, is sustained in terms of the West's, cohesive response to it all, provide a bit of a discouragement, which is much needed to their own ambitions.
I underestimated the toughness of the Ukrainians, and in particular, the toughness of
Putin.
Its president. Yeah, so did Putin. But now we're left with this situation where, you know, there are some people we know that are very smart about this who said that Russia could go in and take Ukraine in 3 days. Well, that has not proved to be the case. And it now looks like Russia is going to escalate, but it's an enormous country. You send people in, it didn't seem like they're going to be able to occupy Ukraine with any real secure grip on the country. And so this is not something that's going to get resolved in the next week or two. This is something that's going to be an ongoing, he's going to have millions of dissidents in Ukraine that he's got to deal with, even if he does succeed militarily.
Again, we'll be watching it closely, Bill, as I know will you, because one of the questions is, do they take out Zelensky? And that clearly seems to have been part of the plan. And if they do they, impose some new puppet regime? And how do the Ukrainian people respond to that? It seems as though this is going to be a festering sore for Putin. I don't know that I'd go so far as to say his days are numbered, as you've intimated, but it certainly isn't working out as he had planned. And whether this nuclear threat is real or not.
Well, Frank, you could probably answer this. You can answer this question. Does Putin really have a strong hand on the nuclear button? Isn't he surrounded by lots of other people that are lots of other men that whose interests may not necessarily pull the trigger
unilaterally, and they would all, execute his orders. I tend to think that is the case. I just think that's the nature of the system that he has presided over. And the other interesting thing on that point, Bill, which I think we've talked about in the past, but it bears remembering at a moment like this when he is engaged in these kinds of nuclear threats, that not only has Putin wholly modernized his nuclear arsenal, including introducing some exotic and terrifying new nuclear weapons in the mix, he's not only, adopted a doctrine that he calls escalate to de-escalate, which clearly countenances the use of nuclear weapons in battlefield contingencies, among other things. But he also has personally presided over, not once, not twice, but repeatedly, strategic nuclear exercises in which the Russian military has simulated attacks against the United States with long-range ballistic missiles and other weapons. And by the way, in some of those instances, has actually had Chinese participation in the exercises. So I mean, this is a guy who takes that particular point very seriously. And I've been hearing news reports today that just the past couple of days that the Russians agreed with the United States that a nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. That's not Vladimir Putin's view at all. I think it's deception at the very least. Hey, Bill, before we run out of time, I did want to just ask you about one other thing. Not unrelated to this point, you have done on several occasions, I've participated in at least one of them that I can recall, on your wonderful television program, The Bill Walton Show, programming about the vulnerabilities of our electric grid, notably with our friend Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. There has been, this weekend, as you may have seen, a really stunning piece by 60 Minutes. And again, it wasn't news perhaps to your audience or mine, but I think to a lot of Americans, it probably was hugely shocking to discover that large substation outside of San Jose, California, back in 2013, was very nearly destroyed by unknown persons. The estimation of our colleague Mike Mabee, who featured prominently in the 60 Minutes piece, by the way, a 700 terrorist attacks against the grid in the past decade. And it raises the question, doesn't it, that if the grid is this vulnerable, whether it's to physical sabotage or cyber attacks or electromagnetic pulse or solar weather or whatever, shouldn't we be about fixing those vulnerabilities right quick? And would you agree with me that that ought to be something that Joe Biden talks about tonight in his State of the Union address, which will proceed in most markets our conversation? But I just want your thoughts on whether this rises to the level of importance that should feature prominently in such an address to the nation.
It should be front and center in importance. And to fix the electric grid is not trillions of dollars, it's billions of dollars and single digit billions of dollars. And we could do it. And we could do it fairly expeditiously, as Peter Pry explains. But this calls to mind why the situation with Putin and Russia is so dangerous, is that our foreign policy and national defense leadership is so unserious, so unprepared to deal with real threats. You know, they're running after still global warming. John Kerry has said this is the Russian invasion. Gosh, he hopes it doesn't interfere with our plans to move to green energy. And then also we've got Lloyd Austin concerned about Mark Milley concerned about white rage in the U.S. military and white supremacism, and they think those are the biggest threats facing the United States. These are the men who would be recommending addressing the problems with the grid, and that they're not doing it is to me a fireable offense. It's almost treason, because they're smart people who know that this is an issue. you know, coming back to Ukraine, one thing surprises me is that Putin has not done that to Ukraine. They have the capability to do it, and maybe they don't want to tip their hand with regard to EMP. If they did it with Ukraine, it might stiffen our resolve to do something here. And so it may be just a strategic feint that's being implemented. It's a big concern, and oh, that Biden would talk about it tonight would just be fantastic. Because you know, for the first time in my life, I'm really worried about being incinerated. I mean, these people blunder after blunder after blunder. And Trump had the Nord Stream 2 pipeline shut down. Obama was not for it. And then the first thing Biden does in January or July of last year is they open the whole thing up. And that pipeline is 100% owned by the Gazprom, the Russian oil and gas company. So the interrelationships here are fascinating and dangerous.
They are indeed. Bill, this is why we value so much your contributions to the program, helping us work through all of these, and I look forward to our conversation with you again next week. Thanks for your time today, my friend. Keep up the great work you do at the Bill Walton Show. Next up, we will speak with Colonel Chuck DeVore, United States Army retired, about this Ukraine business on the tactical and strategic levels, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a friend and colleague of many years, a man of considerable ability who has distinguished himself in public service, both in the uniform of the United States Army, as well as a civilian in the Defense Department back when men were men in the Reagan years, as well as a state legislator in California, which he served in the assembly there, and now as a vice president of the highly regarded Texas Public Policy Foundation in Texas. He is Chuck DeVore, retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Army Reserves, and a man of, as I say, considerable insight into things like what we're confronting at the moment from Vladimir Putin as he continues his invasion of Ukraine. Chuck, it's good to have you back. Welcome once again to Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Frank.
So give us a sort of 30,000-foot situation report on this invasion, now in day 6, I guess, or 7. How's it going as you see it, and how do you think Vladimir Putin sees it?
Well, I don't think it's going particularly well for Russian planners. I think at the onset, they had the notion that they could quickly march into Kyiv and topple the government. Complete chaos, there'd be paralysis, that the Ukrainian forces would not put up a fight. In fact, perhaps they thought that was the case because veteran active duty Ukrainians are off in the east facing the Donetsk and Luhansk areas where you have a majority of Russian speakers that Putin armed and sent Russian officers to lead. At the same time, he took back Crimea in 2014. And I say took back because, of course, Crimea, while under Ukrainian control historically, has not been a part of Ukraine. But these separatist regions certainly have been. And so the cream of the Ukrainian army was over in the east. And so presumably Putin thought he could just march right into Kyiv and kick President Zelensky out of office and install his own puppet government. And of course, that has not happened. And so as a result, Putin's invasion force is, by my understanding, inadequate to the task of controlling a restive large nation that has risen up and is now a nation in arms, which was a term first ascribed to Napoleonic France during the revolutionary period of French history. When you saw this remarkable transition in Europe from these professional small royal armies to these mass levies. And that's what you're seeing in Ukraine, the spontaneous eruption of patriotic fervor that's rallying to the banner of President Zelensky in the defense of the Ukrainian homeland. And so I think Putin has a really, really difficult challenge. And I don't understand how, given the current forces he's deployed, how he can achieve victory. It just doesn't seem possible at this moment.
Well, I guess it's a question of what does the victory look like, isn't it? If it's going to be a matter of does Putin topple the government of Ukraine and put in a puppet regime and then, you know, maintain such a presence there as to prop it up. It may not be a complete victory, especially if it's, you know, sort of an ongoing, rear guard action or insurrection or whatever you want to call it, guerrilla war by the Ukrainians. But do you think that's what he's intent on achieving? Partial victory, though it may be.
Right now, I think he just needs to have some success. And so it seems to me that what you're likely going to see is the continued destruction of Kharkiv, the second largest city in Ukraine. You're likely going to see increased use of these large thermobaric weapons that can level entire city blocks, and perhaps try to show the destruction of Kharkiv as an example to the citizens of Kyiv. And then regarding Kyiv, he's got to surround it. He's got to cut it off. And his forces right now in the theater are inadequate to that task. It's a very large city. If he wants to make the inner ring tighter, he's got to have some urban warfare, which is going to cause enormous casualties on both sides. But if he wants to skirt the city and have a larger inner ring to surround the city, it's going to be very large. And it's going to take a lot more troops to do that than he currently has in that area. So it seems to me he's got to reduce Kharkiv. He's got to take Sumy. He's got to then establish secure routes from the Russian border in the region of Kursk and Belgorod, moving to the west to Kyiv. And that's where you've got your larger railroads and your larger roads. The roads coming down from the Chernobyl salient on the Belarus-Ukrainian border are very, very small roads. They are confined by the tail end, the eastern end of the Pripyat Marsh. And so that means that if you go any sort of off-road movement off that main supply route coming down from Chernobyl, you're going to get bogged down. You're going to get stuck in mud. And so there's plenty of places on that small road coming down from Chernobyl where you have canalization, you have choke points in these little villages and forested areas and bridges. It's just about the worst possible main supply route you could ever imagine if you were a logistician. And that's why they really got to get that spearhead from the east, from Sumy, from Kharkiv, over to Kyiv. Because without that, I don't think that they can successfully surround and besiege Kyiv. So we may still be weeks away from that actually happening.
You're talking about a lot of geography that I think most of our listeners, and frankly, yours truly, is not all that familiar with. But it does bring up a question that has been on my mind since I first heard about this column coming, I gather, from Belarus in the north down towards Kyiv. It's been described as being 40 miles long. And even if the roads aren't, you know, narrow and as you say, you know, canalized, they would seem to me to be highly susceptible to, you know, sapper attacks or other disruptions that could make a further mess of logistics, which has been, it seems, a real problem for Putin's army from the get-go, is it not?
Yeah, it is a real problem. And again, I think this goes back to underestimating their enemy. Look, logistics are hard. It's one of the hardest things you can do in the military. You're synchronizing the arrival of food, ammunition, fuel, and you're synchronizing it with projected battle actions. And you have to do it in a way that you don't sacrifice your logisticians. You have to be able to do that and keep the fight going. And the Russians have failed at that. And oh, by the way, the Russians have traditionally been weak at logistics. In World War II, it wasn't really until 1944 that the Russians started to really optimize their logistics capabilities. But prior to that, they'd do these great offensives against the Germans, and they'd run out of ammunition and fuel, and the Germans would counterattack. And that's what's happening here. And so with that huge column, that 40-mile-plus column, based on overhead imagery that we've seen from that civilian satellite firm, assuming that it could be trusted, and looking at the mix of vehicles, it seems to me that most of those vehicles are resupply trucks with some local security, some air defense, some tanks, some armored personnel carriers. So I'm guessing there's probably about 1,000 trucks in that column. Seems like a lot, doesn't it? Except that when you break it down and you understand how much each truck can carry, then you're looking at approximately 4 to 5 days worth of supplies and food and fuel for the forces that have been committed to the Kyiv area. Maybe more. It depends on whether there's 10,000 or there's 30,000. And so what you're really seeing is a resupply column. Probably has a lot of artillery ammo, missiles, fuel. But that's needed. And they, by the way, Frank, they need to do that constantly to keep the forward momentum of this offensive going, which is why I think that you're not going to see a lot of action in front of Kyiv until the Russians secure the east along their eastern border with Ukraine in the vicinity of Sumy and Kharkiv. Those areas have to be taken. Those transportation hubs have to be secured. And at that point, you're going to start to be able to see a significant increase in throughput of those supplies into the Kyiv operation.
Let me come back to something you touched on a moment ago, Chuck DeVore, and that is the use of these so-called thermobaric weapons to inflict immense destruction. They're not as horrific as nuclear weapons in that capacity, obviously, but they are a lot more destructive than your average conventional piece of ordnance. When you say that they are destroying Kharkiv, as perhaps an example of what will befall Kyiv if it does not surrender, what do you mean? What is the extent of that destruction at this point? And the loss of life, at least as it's been reported to date, seems very much smaller than what we would expect with that level of destruction, does it not?
Right. So first of all, it's important to understand that there are at least two varieties of thermobaric weapons being used in the theater. One I would describe as like a super bunker buster. It's a tactical missile. You see it sometimes on top of T-72 chassis. And if you have a particularly well-constructed bunker that's been giving your forward troops a hard time, you can launch one of those and essentially collapse the bunker and kill everybody in it. So that does use thermobaric principles. It is a thermobaric weapon, but it's not the kind I'm talking about.
What are those principles for those not familiar with this term?
Well, what it does is a normal bomb, a normal conventional bomb has to have the oxidizer and the fuel in the bomb material, in the explosive. So when you detonate a normal explosive, it's like gunpowder, right? So gunpowder has a mixture of charcoal and sulfur, which are the fuel, and it has saltpeter, which is the oxidizer, the oxygen, if you will, that allows the fuel to work. So without that oxidizer, all you have in a bomb then is just something that is flammable, right? It doesn't explode. So how does a thermobaric weapon work? Well, the way it works is the fuel is in the weapon, but the oxidizer is the oxygen in the atmosphere itself. And so what happens is it sprays particulates, fuel particulates in a cloud, and then ignites them. And then what you see is the sustained pressure wave that flattens everything within the blast radius. It liquefies internal organs. It collapses lungs. It sucks up the oxygen, so maybe if you survive, you might not have enough oxygen to breathe for a while. And it's capable of flattening city blocks. And so it's important to sift through the propaganda, of course. There's a lot of propaganda being generated by both sides. Obviously, most of us in America are more sympathetic to one side's information warfare than the other. But there's been some evidence that a larger thermobaric weapon was used on a Ukrainian military post and wiped out 70 soldiers in one shot. Now, there's also evidence of a more traditional missile or artillery strike that was conducted on a Kharkiv municipal building. This is attacking civilian infrastructure, civilian political leadership. Those two things together are kind of a troubling combination that would suggest that if the Russians want to avoid brutal urban fighting, which is what they'll get as they press into Kharkiv, and if they press into Kyiv, right, they're going to lose a lot more troops than they even have available for the operation if they do that. So what's the alternative? Well, you can try to surround and starve out the cities, or you can just go in and begin indiscriminately destroying portions of the city and make it easier for the occupiers to then come in and control the core of the city. That's what I'm concerned about, is that latter option where the Russian officers reporting back up to the chain to Putin are reporting back that resistance is more stiff than we anticipated. If we go in, our casualties are going to be in the thousands and thousands, will become combat ineffective. So what do you want us to do, boss? Should we reduce Kharkiv to ash and have that be that terror attack be an example to the rest of Ukraine? Or should we just bypass the city and just keep it surrounded?
The idea of a siege that would starve out a resisting population would seem to be unlikely in a circumstance in which Putin now finds himself, in which, I must say, to my surprise, there has been a degree of unanimity and, well, relative robustness on the part of Europe, not just NATO, but the European Union and even nations that have generally been considered to be outliers on all of this, that are bringing to bear sanctions, blocking flights, you know, seizing assets, or at least, rounding them up, if not actually taking possession of them, of Russian oligarchs, including Putin himself. Talk a little bit about what Europe's done to date, Chuck DeVore, and what it likely is meaning for the people of Russia as well as their ruler.
Right. So I think this is an extremely important aspect of this conflict. And let's go back to, a few days ago when everyone expected the Ukrainian government to fall. And the American government under President Biden offered President Zelensky and his family a ride out of Kyiv. And what did he say in response? I don't need a ride. I need ammunition. And so that defiant stance, his staying in his capital city, to me, was somewhat evocative of General McAuliffe at Bastogne in 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge, when the German commander said, we've got you surrounded. Any deaths will be on civilians, will be on you. You should surrender. And the one-word reply was nuts. And of course, we know the rest is history, that the Germans were unsuccessful. That was Zelensky's Battle of the Bulge moment. That was his Bastogne moment. And because the Russians were unable to get information dominance, because they couldn't shut down the internet in Ukraine, because they weren't able to jam the TV and radio signals, and still, to this day, you see significant amounts of information, video, some real, some perhaps staged, hard to tell at this point. What really matters, though, is the effect it has on public opinion. And so then, for example, when you had Zelensky's speech to the European Union, it had a significant effect. And now you have the European Union that has essentially given Ukraine an unlimited line of credit to buy whatever they need on the market to be able to defend themselves. This is like the version of Lend-Lease that America had to keep Britain and the Soviet Union afloat during World War II. This is significant. And so what that means is that financially, every day, Ukraine's going to get stronger and Russia's going to get weaker from a financial standpoint. And it's going to be very hard for me to understand how Russia can come out of this, even if China tries to bail them out. Because, Frank, there's not very robust communications nets between China and Russia. And by that, I mean pipelines and the Trans-Siberian Railroad. They're just not that big. It's not enough. They don't have enough throughput to give the Chinese the sort of minerals and fuel that they need to be able to pay for this war. And as a result, the Chinese are probably going to ask for some things like concessions, especially given the history between the two of them. How ironic might it be, given that Imperial Russia had set up massive colonies in Manchuria all the way down to what was then known as Port Arthur. How ironic would that be if China reverses and says, look, Putin, if you want $100 billion from us to continue your fight, you're going to have to give us a 99-year lease on Siberian mineral areas or fuel, or you're going to have to give us a lease on a naval base up in the Arctic Circle, because we think that perhaps the Great Circle or the Northwest Passage will then start to be operational and we want to be up there. So I think Putin is in a really, really vulnerable place right now economically. And I think that you're already seeing that, Frank, two oligarchs are reported to have complained to him in the last day that this isn't good for
beginning
Russian
to bite. Yeah. You know, with respect to China, Chuck, I saw a report that the Chinese have stopped purchasing coal from Russia and are now buying it from Mongolia instead. I don't know whether that will translate as well into cutting off imports of gas or oil, which the Chinese certainly desperately need, and whether they've got alternative sources.
Well, that's a remarkable report. I know that about a month ago, I saw where they had inked a deal for 100 million tons of coal from Russia. So if that's the case, then they're already reneging on that agreement.
Well, apparently it is prompted by the action on this so-called SWIFT system and the payments and all the rest of it that has prompted the Chinese to, I'm not sure whether it's renege or whether it's just, you know, putting it on hold for the time being. But the time being is obviously very much uppermost in Putin's mind. Leslie, let me turn to one other piece of this, which you've just written about in The Federalist today, Chuck DeVore, and that is what Vladimir Putin is doing in response to all of this, particularly the help that the Europeans are giving to the Ukrainians, brandishing his nuclear capabilities, heightening their alert status, and it seems rather transparently threatening the use of not just these thermobarics, but much, much, much more powerful weapons, nuclear ones at that. Your thoughts on what he's up to? Could it go?
Well, right. So I think there's three things that we ought to consider looking at this. Number one, he's reminding the world that he is a nuclear power, and that completely transforms the dimensions of this conflict. He's trying desperately to frighten the Europeans away from helping out Ukraine, blocking some of these arms shipments, for example, or preventing the transfer of these old Warsaw Pact aircraft that the Ukrainians know how to fly and some of the NATO members have kept in flyable condition, like the MiG-29. So that's number one. That may just be a standard sort of warning that, hey, you know, there are consequences. Now, the likelihood of using them, I think, is vanishingly small, nevertheless, it's a threat, and it's a significant threat. I think the second thing that we need to consider is that you have these reports that Putin may, in fact, be losing control, that from a psychological or a medical standpoint, he's under a lot of stress and strain. He's increasingly isolated. He's 69 years old. He's very paranoid. So this could be one of those things like, okay, I'm going to take you all out with me if I go down. And so then that opens the question, yes, maybe they will be used. If he orders it, would the rocket forces actually execute the order? I think it's important at this point to understand that 4 years ago, Putin reestablished the Zampoli, the political officers that had been abolished for many years. These are people who enforce political discipline and allegiance to Putin. And so they are back in play in the Russian military and presumably in the strategic rocket forces as well. The third thing I think that we need to look at is this should remind everybody that we oughtn't to ignore the modernization and upgrade of our nuclear deterrent. Nobody thinks that they're going to be used, but in fact, of course, they have been used in war before by the United States in 1945 against Imperial Japan. And when you have a weapon, there's always the temptation to use it, and there's a greater temptation to use it if you believe that your opponent has no ability to respond. And certainly, we need to pay a lot of attention to this because the People's Republic of China has been engaged in a massive nuclear buildup. And for too many years, we have just listened to their assurances that, oh, we only want less than 100 nuclear weapons, and we're really not building up. And now, of course, we understand, as they're beginning to throw off the curtain themselves and say, surprise, in fact, we have been building up a significant nuclear force. And no doubt that nuclear force will continue to grow significantly out of the People's Republic of China.
And exceed our own capabilities, would be my guess, in the not-too-distant future, frankly. Certainly deployed systems. And just a thought on that subject, Chuck, of course, the Russians have engaged in a massive nuclear modernization program, too, by the account of our colleague Mark Schneider. They have some 22 systems that have been recently deployed.
Right. Well, I mean,
but I want to just ask you, it's not just the numbers of weapons or their modernization. It's also the degree to which Putin has put into place a doctrine for their use, escalation to de-escalate, I think is what he calls it. And he's also, and just a quick thought on this, if you would, Chuck, because you've been in this business for a long time, he's also presided personally over numerous strategic forces exercises, some of them involving Chinese forces as well, by the way, in which they simulate attacks with thermonuclear weapons against the United States. All of this is the sort of thing that, as you say, at a minimum should prompt us to realize we had best get cracking on the long overdue modernization of our own deterrent, no?
Right. So I think it's important to understand that if you look at the doctrine, Russian nuclear doctrine, as a continuum from Soviet nuclear doctrine, it's important to understand that the Soviets never really admitted to, not in their doctrine, they may have diplomatically to kind of calm Western nerves, but in their doctrine, they never admitted to any sort of a break. They saw rather nuclear weapons as part of a continuum, a smooth continuum of force from, if you will, the point of a bayonet all the way up to thermonuclear devices, H-bombs. And so they never really distinguished between, for example, a 500-pound bomb and a so-called tactical battlefield nuclear weapon. They were all fair game in their doctrine of under the old Soviet Union. And so that's the doctrine under which Putin grew up. That's the doctrine under which he would have studied as a professional. And so that's why it's so important, going back to your point about the 20-plus systems that they've worked on. Remember, nuclear weapons are, in a significant way, a labor-saving device, if you want to put it that way. If you went back to the post-Korean War U.S. military, as we were quickly adding nuclear weapons under President Eisenhower, we had this concept of being able to save money by having a smaller conventional force and having a lot of nuclear weapons, including nuclear weapons that were fired out of 8-inch artillery tubes.
More bang for the buck, I think, is how it was described.
Exactly. And we called it the Pentomic Army. And it was designed to fight in a nuclear environment, in these spread out forces, wearing protective gear and having enhanced communications capabilities, and never concentrating except for a very quick thrust to, for example, concentrate for a quick breakthrough, but you never wanted to present a large target to the enemy for him to do the same to you. And so that was the concept. And Frank, the only reason why it went away was because the new president, John F. Kennedy, realized that this, kind of thinned out military would be insufficient to the task of containment and fighting in far-flung places in these proxy wars like in Vietnam. The Pentomic Army would have not been able to muster the sort of manpower to fight in Vietnam. And so Kennedy also did a conventional buildup. And so I think it's really important to understand that nuclear weapons, that for military planners, are really viewed as legitimate tools that you're going to want to use if you don't have a large military.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that's the case of the U.S. military, Chuck, any longer. I remember Colin Powell famously saying, you know, the N-word was sort of passé, and by that he meant the nuclear word. But I think what you've really helped us understand is that may not be the view of other militaries, and certainly it's not the case with Vladimir Putin's. Chuck, there's so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back for an even longer conversation. This has been very, very edifying, and I appreciate your expertise as well as your insights tremendously. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm that fights for faith and freedom in federal and state courts across the country. Make no mistake, we are living in dangerous times. Left-wing progressives in government are assaulting our Constitution like no other time in the history of our great nation. Indeed, we hear politicians at the highest levels of government and a major political party espousing what they believe to be the benefits of socialism and the unrestrained growth of the federal government. Fortunately, our Constitution was designed to prevent tyranny and to protect liberty. It enshrines fundamental freedoms in the Bill of Rights, which was designed as a brake on the power of government. In short, our Constitution was designed to protect private citizens like you and me from the tyranny of government. I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center will do its part to hold tyrannical government officials accountable in our courts of law so that we, the people, remain a free people. You can support the important work of the American Freedom Law Center with a tax-deductible donation. Please visit our website at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden's State of the Union address tonight will likely feature promises of more federal spending aimed at advancing the radical left's fundamental transformation of our country and spinning of his administration's abysmal foreign policies. A shocking 60-minute segment aired on Sunday should prompt Mr. Biden to include in his remarks several concrete and immediate actions to address what is arguably the most important public policy issue of all, the danger that our electric grid is vulnerable to potentially catastrophic takedown. The president must make protecting the grid against all hazards a top priority, create a czar responsible for performing it, secure legislation requiring electric utilities to do their part and prevent them from utilizing likely compromised equipment from China and other hostile powers. We must secure the grid now, before it sustains devastating attack endangering tens of millions of Americans. This is Frank Gaffney. We'll